Hey, and just a quick reminder that the audio-only versions of these Vital MX interviews are available on the Vital MX podcast page. Search for it anywhere you get your pods and let your friends know about it. Hey guys, back with another Vital MX Industry Insights. This time I've got CEO and co-founder of Dustmoto, Mr. Colin Godby, on the phone. What's going on, Colin?
Not much. Just getting off the road, doing a bit of testing over in Utah and getting back into it here in Bend.
That's awesome, dude. I mean, look, electric motorcycles are starting to take over the world. It feels like there's, you know, there are a few people who are not really falling in suit with enjoying these things, but there's a lot of cool technology out there. So I'm really excited to learn more about Dustmoto. What I like to do with these, first of all, is get a little background on you. Where did you grow up? How did you get into dirt bikes? You know, what's your background?
Yeah, totally. Happy to talk about that stuff. So I was actually born in Florida, but spent most of my childhood in Southern California and in Orange County. In high school, moved over the hills into Murrieta, Temecula area, and was completely surrounded by the moto scene down there. So, you know, grew up driving by McGrath and Emig's compounds, essentially.
That's awesome.
I started BMX after breaking my arm straight through at 3.5 years old on a bike with training wheels. I got into BMX a little bit later, right around kind of 10, 11 years old, and sort of fell in love with competing on two wheels. And this is where I think my perspective is kind of interesting in the context of a moto industry conversation. My dad came home with an XR80 about the same time I started BMXing. And my mom looked at him and said, "Take that thing back. My brothers have been riding motorcycles on the street too much, getting injured, and I don't want my kids to die in an accident on the road." And so that was sort of the beginning of my relationship with motorcycles, was sort of this perspective of, okay, there's some, you know, some risk here. But as I continued to grow up, you know, got better at BMX, dirt jumping, into mountain biking, I always jumped at the opportunity to get out and ride with my buddies who had motorcycles. So I basically would get out on some trail rides, would get out on the track. You know, Milestone was a spot that some of my friends and coworkers would go to, as well as Elsinore. And so I always was, let's say, jumping at the opportunity to ride moto and was capable on the bike, but never actually came to owning and really getting into the sport until later in my career.
Oh, that's interesting. That's normally most people we talk to have raced most of their life. So yeah, and rode a lot. So it took a little bit of time, but you had the passion, and that's really what's important.
Yeah. So, and kind of in terms of the racing side of things, I have spent sort of the better part of the last 15 years racing mountain bike. And so it's downhill and enduro racing, you know, in Fontana, and then all over kind of the Rocky Mountains and big mountain race series, and done a little bit of Enduro World Series races as well. And so definitely accustomed to sort of the high level of racing preparation. I've also done a good bit of kind of off-road. So I've raced as a navigator in Baja 500 a couple times, in Baja 1000, as well as the Porsche Cayenne for a Trans-Siberia rally. So motorsports and sort of racing on two wheels is definitely something I'm really familiar with. And what's funny is I kind of grew up idolizing, you know, the Supercross and motocross stars, and followed it closely. And I think this is kind of where it starts to dovetail into the story of Dust, was kind of coming from this adjacent industry and always wanting the opportunity to break into it, and finally finding that chance through getting into developing kind of these electric products. So, I would say a little bit of a atypical path into the sport and into the industry, but really excited to be jumping in.
Yeah, I'm excited for this whole revolution of electric bikes. I think it's really cool. And so, yeah, your career path, you have 20 years of new product development with quote unquote big consumer tech brands. I was reading up on you a little bit, and so 10 years of working in electric vehicles. You've worked with, it looks like, Disney, Skullcandy, Glowfuge, numerous others. But I kind of want to hear more about the electric vehicles background you have. How did you get into that? How'd you get started?
Yeah, so actually kind of interesting story, where it's almost like my professional career has been bookended by vehicle development. So one of my first real jobs out of college was with a company called Millenworks in Tustin, California. Company of Rod Millen, sort of the Pikes Peak Hill Climb record holder and rally hero. And it was as a mechanical engineer developing various vehicle technology and prototype demonstrators. And so we had a number of contracts. We did work with Toyota doing concept cars. We did work with Lockheed Martin and Textron building military vehicle demonstrators of new technologies, armored vehicles that were electric and, you know, had really advanced suspension systems, MR dampers, these sorts of things. And also worked on theme park rides there as well. And awesome. I really cut my teeth as an engineer because we had sort of the dream integrated environment where engineers are on the second floor, the shop's on the first floor. We could just walk our drawings straight down to the shop and they could tell us how terrible our designs were. and that really kind of kicked off this interest in learning how to do things the right way, how to optimize your designs for weight and structural performance and safety, and also kind of a variety of vehicle applications. We even did some early work with Yamaha back in the day, working on snow bikes, working on, I would say, we didn't realize it at the time, but some of the earliest side-by-side projects, including one where we had sort of a Hayabusa-based V8 dropped into a super lightweight sand rail. And so it's a really cool experience being surrounded by kind of advanced development in the automotive industry. And a lot of folks from Millenworks have gone on to work at some of the biggest automotive vehicle and EV manufacturers out there. So that was kind of my intro, is really learning how to do it right, you know, in a race environment, motorsports environment, as well as defense and, you know, kind of safety critical aspects of theme park rides. But I really wanted to dive into, you know, mass production, understanding consumer interests and, you know, what drove sales and marketing. And so that's when I jumped over to Skullcandy and really got the chance to produce, let's say, millions of products a year. And travel all over the world to go to factories and understand mass production. And so that was a really interesting space where I got to work with startups. I got to build teams. I got to build lots of product and learn kind of the best practices for product development. And then sort of loop back into vehicle development with my last role before starting Dust at a company called UBCO. And UBCO is a New Zealand-based electric vehicle manufacturer making utility bikes, basically.
Uh-huh.
Two-wheel drive farm bikes, almost in a way like the modern, you know, Trail 90 type of thing. And while I was there, I led the product engineering and design groups as the chief product officer. And that's really what kind of got me back into a space of wanting to really lean harder into developing performance applications in kind of the moto world. I had done some side projects developing downhill mountain bikes with gearboxes and some really interesting things. And I knew I had the toolkit after kind of a full career to jump in kind of both feet into a space that we saw that was underrepresented, which is kind of a performance middle market dirt bike that I think lowered the barrier of entry into the sport for a lot of folks.
Yeah, it's super exciting. Something you said, or a couple things you said, got me thinking. You talked about working in the electric vehicle platform and learning about doing things the right way and super high quality and making sure that there, you know, it's the best product made. And then you talked about going to Skullcandy where something's mass produced. And sometimes when you think about mass production, you don't necessarily always think about the absolute highest quality. It's decent quality mass production. But when you work in both those environments and learn both those skill sets, I feel like you kind of maybe now with Dust Moto, eventually maybe it could be a mass produced product at the highest quality. I don't know. I just feel like with those two jobs that you, or two careers, you can kind of get the best of both worlds.
Yeah, it's funny you say that because when I first jumped into sort of the consumer product space, you know, I was used to working on these like highly optimized, you know, one or two off projects, right? Where you have a lot of control.
Yeah.
And I struggled a little bit with sort of giving up control in the mass production environment, right? But it really was a great experience kind of developing the understanding, maturity, maybe some wisdom around how to balance those maybe competing forces and actually create a product where you're going deep on all of the areas that matter. You're giving up some control in the areas that aren't worth controlling. Mm-hmm. And ultimately being able to ship a product at a reasonable price at a really high level of quality that hits everything that a customer wants. And I think there's a kind of, if you look out in the industry, there's sort of like both sides of the spectrum. Like there's some folks that struggle a little bit with, wanting to really develop the most advanced, innovative, and frankly expensive systems because they have this really strong vision, right? And unfortunately, and these are really high-end products, and there's a number of them that have gone and frankly some that have failed, but they sometimes struggle to find customers, right? And then on the other end of the spectrum are these really mass-produced products that by the time they make it to the customer, they either completely miss the performance marks or they fall apart or they're not serviceable and these sorts of things, right? And that's where we think the sweet spot is. And honestly, the traditional power sports industry does this quite well. It's a mature industry, right? Serviceability, kind of modification, reliability, like dirt bikes take a freaking beating. And there's a lot of new players that don't really understand how much work and development has gone into these platforms to get there. And so we're hoping to kind of bridge that gap and say like, hey, we're based in the US. We get how these products are used. We're surrounded by it growing up and, you know, doing motorsports racing ourselves. We know what it takes to build kind of a performant, reliable product. And at the same time, we got to kind of hit the mark where it can be sold to a customer for a reasonable price.
Absolutely. Let's get into the history of Dust Moto real quick. It's an American electric dirt bike company. You've talked about that. How did this come about with your with COO Neil Tierney and then your head of design Jarrett Volkoff? I hope I said that right. Yep. What's the history? How did you guys decide? Why did you guys decide to jump in feet first?
Yeah, so Neil, Jarrett, and I all met at UBCO. So Neil was the CMO there, and I had hired Jarrett as our senior industrial designer to be based out of our Bend office that I had put together. So we're based in Bend, Oregon now for Dust, and I had built sort of a satellite development office for UBCO in Bend. And we all connected and sort of hit it off really strongly, built a strong rapport and working relationships. And within sort of Neil and my role, sort of this leadership level perspective of what's going on in the industry, what we were trying to do at UBCO, how we were trying to open adjacent markets and bring in new customers, we had identified some trends and let's say insights in the industry that we weren't quite ready at UBCO to act on. And one of those insights for me was electrification is struggling in the core kind of power sports side of things. And I wanted to understand why. And it turns out there's a number of reasons that we've kind of built the hypothesis around. The other thing that we kind of realized was there's something really interesting happening with Suron and other Chinese brands opening up the low end of the market to new riders. I like to joke that there's never before in the history of the world been more people that can wheelie a motorcycle. And I feel like that's because of Suron. And so like what's happening with this kind of new blood entering into the space and why isn't this sort of being embraced by power sports in the traditional sense, right? Mm-hmm. And so while we're at UBCO, we're working on kind of utility focused products. And we got through a period of, sort of, I think consolidation over the course of, you know, kind of post COVID, whiplash in the consumer space. And we had to kind of unwind some of the investments that we made as a team. And so that gave us the opportunity to keep talking as the group of us to say like, dude, what should we do next? Like, you know, we're talking about some really interesting opportunities and we kind of understand this marketplace better than a lot of other folks. There could be something here. And ultimately it sort of hit us in the face that there's no one that's building an American dirt bike right now. And I add a caveat there. I think the folks at Cobra are awesome, right? They're extremely important to the sport, right? But they're not making dirt bikes for the adult side of the market.
Right. Sure.
and so this is a unique opportunity in time. And if anyone's going to try to do this, let's give it a go, because we know a lot of people are sort of afraid of this, given the sort of macroeconomic state of things, you know, over the last year or so. And so he said, if we can build an American brand that is closely coupled to the industry where the cultural epicenter of the sport is here in the U.S. and the bulk of enthusiast sales globally are here in the U.S. for dirt bikes, if we can tap into that and have that close connection and all that wisdom and passion, then there's an opportunity here to kind of change the way things are done. And the electric perspective doesn't necessarily have to come to the table as sort of this divisive conversation of like, oh, gas is obsolete. Rather, we can approach this of, hey, power sports and moto is an amazing kind of sport and in industry. Can we build an electric product that is interesting and fun and adds to it rather than trying to subtract from, you know, what people love about it?
So yes,
that's kind of how it came together, is like, we saw a few things line up in terms of timing and the industry and said, let's just go make this thing happen.
Yeah, I love that outlook. I really, that's a good way, I think, to pursue this. Another thing you guys have done with the development of this is the crowdfunding approach. I think the initial 50 investors were helping fund the prototype. Kind of talk about that. And then even phase two, I'll call it, of crowdfunding with the first 100.
Yeah. So from the very start, we wanted to tap into a really open development process, and we're not shy in saying, like, and we kind of established this earlier in the conversation, is we're not, the most blooded core, you know, moto industry founders. Right. Mm-hmm. And so we knew it was going to be really important to have a close connectivity to our ultimate customers and bring them into the development cycle. And we also knew that we needed to show traction pretty quickly, given the state of sort of, the macro startup environment and availability of funds. So we said, how can we bring people into the loop early and also establish early traction and get the business rolling? And so we said, well, crowdfund is interesting. Is there another layer of kind of, novelty or unique offering that we can layer into this to make it even more engaging for folks? And so we kind of came up with this idea of doing a monthly subscription where the early backers actually get to join monthly calls with us. We have open communication channels via WhatsApp and email, and we tap them directly for insights and feedback and also just sharing the journey with them. You know, I grew up passionate about 2 and 4 wheels, and I kind of dreamed about designing race cars and motorcycles, but there was never an opportunity to do that, right? The big incumbents have pretty closed off development processes, much of which are based overseas. And I said, you know what, I want to offer this to the passionate public to have their own, you know, sort of shape the story and help develop a dirt bike with us, you know? So we opened up that program, Founders 50, on August 8th, and we closed 50 customers, backers, in the first 24 hours. And so that was a really, really, I think, powerful moment for us to say, oh, wow, okay, there is something here. And this isn't sort of a soft commitment, like $100 refundable. Like, this is real skin in the game for these backers. And that was kind of off to the races from there. Okay, if we can sell 50 bikes, it means we can sell a lot more if we continue to develop this idea out. Mm-hmm. And so with those Founders 50 backers, we were able to raise a little bit of money and build the initial design and our first prototypes and get to testing, right? And that kind of opened up this new phase, which kind of hit on the first 100. Once we sort of de-risked the idea, you know, the classification of this bike, its performance specs, its sizing, you know, ergonomics and what it was to be used for. Essentially, we qualified the concept, you know, proof of concept. We were comfortable then opening up a bit further and bringing some more customers on the journey with us. And that's when we released first 100 last month, for more people to join the party with us. And so we're now, a bit over halfway on the next group of people. So we have over 100 total people signed up and on the journey for Dust. And we actually just had our first call right before jumping on with you. for our inaugural kind of Founders 50 plus first 100 monthly development session.
It's again, so exciting. And I think what I read on with the first 100, if somebody wants to get involved and wants to get their stake in the game early, there's also a little bit of a discount on, I think a 15% discount on if you jump in early.
That's right. Yeah. So there is a single kind of upfront non-refundable deposit. We want serious customers. Yep. We don't want these spots filled by people that are just sitting on, you know, a wait list seat. But from there, it's basically 14 more payments of $500 to get your bike, with a final payment to get you at $9,300. So that's 15% off the list price. It's, you know, in the grand context of things, sort of our idea is to provide approachable performance and a unique experience. We know a lot of the higher performing electric motorcycles, street or off-road, are quite expensive, right?
Yes.
And so we wanted to hit this space where in a price point that's not too foreign to a traditional dirt bike purchaser or even a high-end mountain bike purchaser, they can get something that's really compelling when it comes to power to weight ratio and kind of ultimate performance. And so, yeah, we still have slots open on first 100 for folks to kind of join this journey, get behind the scenes access with us as a team, and get one of the first 100 production bikes built for a discount.
Yeah, if you guys are listening, dustmoto.com, there's tons of information there, and you can also find them on social media, on Instagram. You talked about the prototype, which I think you had the first working prototype in about 6 months, and testing. Josh Hill, among others, have rode this bike. What's been the feedback?
Yeah, so that was a pretty fun story, getting Josh and then our buddy Tucker Neary, electric cycle rider, kind of some of the first couple of days to throw a leg over it. We had just finished the bike basically, you know, 48 hours before those guys jumped on. And actually Justin Hill also jumped on in the first day there. You know, the feedback was, hey, this is a real motorcycle. It doesn't feel like a toy. It doesn't feel like a mountain bike, which is exactly what we're going for. But at the same time, it was sort of this feedback that was like, it is different than a full-size bike. And that kind of this proof of concept mentality with Alpha, like we really wanted to prove that hypothesis that right now electric tech could actually be the perfect answer for this performance play bike segment. So instead of trying to replace a 250 or 450, you know, out on the track or the big enduro ride, there's a lot of use cases where a smaller, lighter, but quite capable bike, could fit the bill and actually the electric performance shines. And so backyard tracks, ripping single tracks, sessioning out in the hills with your friends, you know, practicing whips and stuff. This bike is kind of fun sized for, I would say, a high level rider. It's still got 21 inch front wheel, 19 or 18 rear. It's about 2 inches shorter on standover and about 2 inches shorter on wheelbase, but it's, you know, in between a full size bike and a super mini basically. And so the feedback that they gave was like, this actually works. I don't feel cramped. It feels like a motorcycle. It feels like I can get around and move on this, and I can actually attack corners and features that maybe I wouldn't be comfortable on, like sort of a smaller kind of electric bike, you know?
Yeah.
And since then, we've now gotten a bunch more riders on it. Our good friends, Joey Lancaster and Rory Sullivan up here in the Pacific Northwest, Justin Homan, local guy, you know, obviously FMX, kind of metal militia back in the day, a bunch of mountain bike crossover folks, and a bunch of different terrains. And really the feedback kind of comes through as, A, I feel comfortable out of the box. B, it performs like a real dirt bike. And C, it corners unlike anything that I've ever ridden.
That's awesome. Dude, yeah, the only thing I've really ever rode was the Alta. So I'm pretty excited about some of these bikes coming out because I really think the future, these have a place in the future of our sport, or just even the, you know, the weekend warriors. And something I was thinking about, and I guess this is probably not, this is everybody's probably thought of this, but like if a kid maybe who's learning to ride, say, you know, I don't know, 13, 14 year old kid could get a bike like this with electric, it's so tunable, right? You could turn it down and I would assume you can start to learn to ride. And as you get better, you can turn it up and it would fit. If you just go get a 450, it's too much bike for most people. You kind of have to start out on a 125 and maybe move to a 250F, et cetera. With something like this, it kind of meets all skill levels.
Yeah, no, it's a big part of our positioning. And I don't know what the best sort of analogy is, you know, in other industry, but it's almost like we kind of think about this performance middle market, almost like a Chevy Corvette, which is like, you know, a race car driver can jump into a Corvette at Laguna Seca and turn some wicked lap times, right? But it's also approachable enough where someone could take this to the coffee shop, right? So we have a really good example of that, actually. 2 days ago in Southern Utah, we just drove back. So we were riding with some local guys down there, the Palmer compound boys, Kyston and Caden, and they were able to sort of take the bike, kind of build up, and then they sent their backyard triple, good sized triple, you know, sort of 60-ish feet, and some footage is going to come out of that. But then we pack it up, we bring the bike back to our Airbnb. We're working with this group of college kids on doing some data acquisition for their senior project. And one of the students was like, hey, does anyone want to try it before you take it apart and stuff and travel back? And one was like, yeah, I want to try. And really, really confident. But then he gets on and I was like, okay, have you ridden a motorcycle? He's like, no, never. Oh, and I was like, okay. I was like, okay, so this is going to be interesting. But I was like, look, we've got three ride modes. Like the Palmer boys are in ride mode 3. Let's switch it down to ride mode 1. And I was able to, and no joke, teach him how to ride a motorcycle for the first time in his life in less than 2 minutes because of the flexibility of these, you know, platforms. It's a really, I think, unique space that we're now in, that we can allow for people to jump on a bike and ride it super aggressively. And at the same time, the next day, you know, a new rider can jump on and learn. And to be honest, that was one of the things that struck me about the Stark, which was, you know, if someone really wanted to get into racing at a high level, it's quite an interesting bike, you know, and they're full size adult or something like that and have some experience on a dirt bike, that thing would progress with you, right? Mm-hmm. Because of the flexibility and ride modes. And so I think we fit a different, you know, space. But yeah, 13-year-old, you know, grew up on, you know, some of the smaller bikes, you jump into this and actually kind of cover a lot of the categories and it will grow with them, so to speak.
Yeah, I think that's definitely a benefit of it. I got a few more questions and I'll give some credit. My co-host of my podcast, TJ, he's really big into electric bikes right now. He just built his own using like a Honda frame and some electric motor he got off the internet. I don't know anything about it. Uh-huh. He loves it. He's absolutely obsessed. And, you know, he has questions, and I think this is a common question. Battery life mm-hmm. versus charge time is a big issue with these things. What are the specs on what you have right now? Mm-hmm. What's the future of battery life, like future solid state batteries? Mm-hmm. What do you have right now, and what do you see coming?
Yeah, no, it's a really good question. And
I hate giving TJ credit, by the way. I hate giving TJ credit.
Nice one, TJ. No, it's a really good question. The obvious answer that everyone hates is it depends, right? And and at some level, it's no different than a gas bike. Like if you're doing, you know, pulls up and down the sand wash all day, it won't be all day, right? It's going to be a lot shorter ride than if you're just cruising around kind of buffed out single track and, you know, sort of third gear, not getting on it, right? But for electric, it's even more amplified because we know the energy density of an electric battery is nowhere near that of gasoline. And so it's one of the reasons why with Dust, we've sort of indexed on this lighter weight, kind of play oriented performance kind of bike is we see a lot of people out that want a session, like kind of ride sessions where it's like 1 to 2 hours, you're on the trails, you're in the backyard, you're up in, you know, kind of hills. And that's a great sort of after work or weekend session, right? Mm-hmm. But it's not necessarily a full 6 hour enduro ride, or it's not, you know, just turning motos at the track. And so for us, what we found is 1 to 2 hours of good riding in a variety of conditions. If you're just ripping laps, it's going to be a short duration. It's going to be 25 minutes, similar to what you can find on the Alta and the Stark, right? But what's cool about it is we have a swappable battery. gives people opportunity to have a second battery that they can drop in if that's what they ultimately want to do. The charge time that we've currently are targeting is 2 hours. And so 1 to 2 hours of riding with the opportunity for additional swappable battery and 2 hours of charging. I think the battery tech is developing rapidly, kind of like we've seen with, you know, sort of memory storage as well as compute power. Like that was a really, you know, kind of Moore's law determined is like rapidly expanding capability. I think batteries following a similar curve, but we're still behind the total energy storage capacity of gasoline. I think it's going to be another 5 to 10 years before you get there. And so if someone is simply looking to completely replace a very specific gas experience, the battery tech's not there yet. And so there are going to be compromises. And you see this with other products, either it's heavier, more expensive or less range or all of those. Right. And that's why we've kind of indexed towards, let's do something different. This is a quiver addition rather than a replacement of all the bikes in your garage. This is something that's super fun. Might be your first electric, but you'll probably keep a gas bike for a while, you know? So yeah, battery tech's moving. It's going to be really exciting to see what happens the next 5 to 10 years. Like you said, with solid state or other chemistries, it's going to get price down. It's going to get weight and volume down. But right now we're trying to find that balance of a bike that you can ride for 1 to 2 hours. It weighs about 200 pounds and can hit all of the kind of terrain that you're looking for, give you that really unique kind of sensation.
Do you see the, like with TVs and electronics over the years, as it's become easier to produce, the prices have come down, where this is also another TJ. Pretty much my next two or three questions are all TJ. So here's your credit, TJ. but electronic, consumer electronics technology has been easier to produce, so the prices have come down. Do you see that being the same with like electronic motorcycles versus gasoline motorcycles, where the price just continues to increase every year?
Yeah. So it, I think that, behavior or trend is pretty accurate. And even, kind of Josh Hill said this, he's like, what's interesting is, you know, there's no real replacement. I think he said this on you know, a podcast that he did. It's like, there's no real replacement still for the 450 class bikes. But what's interesting to him is electric is developing at a much higher rate at this point, right? So you're kind of plateauing on what's possible for the internal combustion technology, but electric is still growing and there's so much more to go, right? And so whether that's cost, like you said, the commodification of kind of the flat screen tech, or even performance, we're going to see rapid changes there. And for us, we can even utilize that for a benefit in terms of where we're at now versus the environment that Alta was trying to operate in. You know, Alta trying to produce 40 or 50 kilowatt of power, you know, sort of 50, 60 horsepower, that was breaking complete new ground when it came to electric powertrain tech. They had to do a lot of heavy lifting to get inverters and battery packs and motors to perform at that level. Well, you know, sort of 10 plus years later, a lot of that level of performance is now almost commodity grade electronics, right?
Yes.
So now there's more options on the market that have already been proven by suppliers that are already building at scale. And so that lets us, instead of having completely invent all of these things, we can potentially partner with proven kind of high quality providers, much like the automotive market or the gas bike market does, to fulfill those objectives. And so that lets us sell a bike for around $10,000. Then that maybe, you know, 10 years ago would have been $15,000. And I do think as more companies pick up on what it takes to build a really, I think, high performance machine, the quality of suspension, you know, kinematics, the structural frame development, and then layer it in with the, you know, more available electronic parts, you're going to start to see the electric bikes become better and more cost effective pretty rapidly.
That's good to hear. Okay. Got two more for you. This is also a TJ question. He was talking about the advancement of what's going on in the automotive manufacturers world. And do you, what the future of automotive electronics is, do you see it, some of the technology from the automotive world working its way into motorcycles? That question is honestly above my head. I don't even know what the heck he's talking about, but I'm sure you have some ideas.
Yeah, some ideas. So I think what you see in automotive, especially kind of credit Tesla with this, but there's a few others, is sort of this software-driven vehicle, mm-hmm. right? And Tesla, you know, this is a situation where like the Toyota CEO went and kind of toured some Tesla plants and looked at the product, and he said like, oh, they have a much bigger head start than we realized. And it's because they sort of developed the product with an integrated hardware and software mentality where all the subsystems are communicating with each other. And they're much more flexible in tuning and updates and all this stuff, right? So I do see elements of that carrying over, because what it allows you to do is create a vehicle that can be, I think, more easily built and updated and improved over time, instead of kind of being locked into the specifics of the hardware. Now, I know there's going to be a lot of people that kind of bristle on that idea. It's like, I actually don't like when all of these cars have so much software, it makes it impossible to work on and all these sorts of things, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And I actually tend to agree. And internally, what we've talked about is making sure that we have a platform that works out of the box, is serviceable, it's not locked down, you know, with sort of kind of software lockouts, and it's also modifiable, right? Some companies are doing a fairly closed environment when it comes to even, you know, some of the automakers, when it comes to updating their electric vehicle platforms and modifying. So we don't want to lose those elements. But the connectedness, I think the quality of software when it comes to controls and throttle mapping and all those sorts of things, we're even starting to see that layer into the gas bikes, right? Like these kind of throttle commanders and, you know, fuel management systems that are being layered in, and people are loving those. And adding launch control and all this stuff, right? So that stuff's going to continue to improve and get better. And the bikes are just going to be more reliable over time as well. So I think there's some trickle down when it comes to the power electronics, you know, reliability, how motors are built, how batteries are built, you know, battery packs that handle temperature better and shock and vibe. Like all the automotive industry, aerospace, there's a lot of best practices that get developed from those industries and then carry over. And I think we'll see that in this case as well.
Okay. I have a personal question. Now, it looks like your bike, the Alpha, correct? The Dust Moto Alpha is the
model? Yeah. It's a model. We're calling the Model 1, but the Alpha bike is the first. It's almost like in kind of new product development, the Alpha is the very first.
Yep.
Testable prototype.
Okay. It looks like you're running handbrakes, front and rear. Is that correct?
Correct. Yep. On the prototype. Yep.
So my question, I would rather have a foot brake because that's what I'm used to. I don't know if that's going to be an option, but I was talking to some buddies the other day about just people riding these electric bikes and how instantaneous the power is. And you know, on a combustion engine bike, you get a little out of control, you get a little whiskey, you can pull mm-hmm. the clutch in and kill that power, and there's no option for that on one of these.
Yeah.
Could you ever see that being an option where, okay, there's a clutch lever that's to kind of regulate the power when you just have a foot brake?
Yeah, it's a super interesting question. So there's actually, I agree with that, first of all. I think when you simplify the system, you take the clutch out, it's just one less control method, mm-hmm. you know, right? Like
yep.
whether it's feathering the clutch through the whoops, or it's, you know, dropping the clutch to get that impulse of torque, or it's actually shutting off power in a moment of need. You kind of lose that without the clutch. There are benefits, right, to a simpler mode of operation as well without gear shifts and clutching, especially for new riders, but also I would say mid to advanced riders in terms of how they can attack kind of braking zones and cornering and focus on good footwork. So it's definitely on my radar. I want to find the right compromise.
Yeah.
What's interesting is I think some people are starting to play with e-clutches, which is actually not necessarily a physical hydraulic clutch, but it does really similar things to the motor where you're able to feather the power output or you're actually able to shut it down. There's stuff you can do around brake. I don't love the brake switch idea, but there is, I think, additional layer of sophistication that can be added so it's not as annoying.
Yeah.
And the concept there is actually on the brake lever, you actually have a electronic switch that tells the motor controller that, hey, brakes being applied, we should cut throttle.
Okay.
Again, I'm not necessarily a huge fan of that, but it's one thing. And then there is actually physical, hydraulic or mechanical clutches. And some companies are also doing those, especially in the trials context. And I think there is a space there. I don't know the exact answer. Right now, on our initial offering, we find that having the kind of full hand controls is a pretty massive unlock for a lot of riders.
Yep.
But we also get the feedback from sort of the deeply experienced core riders, Rory Sullivan, Joey Lancaster, some of them, the Hills, like having the clutch and or foot brake is something you're comfortable with, and there's something potentially there to build on. So we have this commitment internally in terms of R&D to be trying these methods. Being able to mount up a foot brake is important. B, longer term, evaluating if there's a space for some form of clutching to be able to give you that extra layer of control that you might be looking for.
Sure.
But I will say, and I might get some heat for this, I think when you're just thinking about braking and control through corners, take it kind of removing the clutch aspect, 99.9% of riders are going to be faster with handbrakes. Just the ability to modulate and feather and also keep both feet on pegs longer where you want them to be, those sorts of things. So I think it is an interesting unlock if you kind of commit to trying to develop the braking practices with hands.
Yeah, for sure. I think a lot of people are really excited about that. That's something I've heard talked about it a lot. It'd take me a while to adjust, even though when I ride a bicycle, it's just mentally, I feel like it'd be more of a struggle, but much cool stuff here. Go ahead.
We've actually had people that are used to Surons or, smaller electric bikes that have handbrakes, right? Mm. And what's interesting, the feedback they jump on our bike, like, oh, this is a motorcycle.
Yeah.
Right. And so what it ends up doing is it actually flips that switch in some of these, riders' heads. It's like, oh, it's a motorcycle, where's the foot brake? Even though they have experience with Surons and handbrakes and mountain biking, So it is, it's real. I definitely
that's for sure. Yeah, for sure. Well, Colin, this is really cool. Dustmoto.com or dust.moto on Instagram. Anything else you want to let us know about the bike before we let you go?
No, Jamie, this has been awesome. I think I'm really excited for the opportunity to help shape the future of the sport in a positive way. We want to come in and partner with the industry core riders and the people that have made the sport so awesome already and sort of offer something new and exciting. We see that, there's kind of a storyline that's going about like, what's the future of the sport? Are we losing riders? Are we, kind of losing relevance because there's less people joining the sport, or we're losing riding opportunities? It's harder to open tracks and those sorts of things. And I honestly think that if we do the right things and build the right kinds of products, we can help kind of re-energize the sport by bringing new riders in while still allowing all of the awesome things that we love about the sport that currently exists to stay the same. So that's kind of the way I'm excited to approach this, is get kind of further layered in and meet some amazing people, partner up and building something awesome, and hope to just kind of double down on what's so great about Moto as it stands.
Fantastic. If you guys ever decide to come to Texas to do some testing, TJ's already asked when he can ride one. I would love a chance to jump on one of these. So stay in touch, but this has been a lot of fun, Colin, and I'm super excited to see where this goes. Thank you for your time.
Awesome, Jamie. Thank you so much. It's been great chatting.
Absolutely.